What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. This morning, we're doing a special episode of the pod because last night was the State of the Union address, and Kate and I are going to get into it and talk about what we saw. We're going to talk about it as, you know, talk about the substance of the speech, sort of all the atmospherics around it. And we're even going to get into a little of Kate and my, like, emotional lives. Or kind of our anxieties, right? Because, like, I don't know how to put it. You know, there's a lot at stake here, and I think a lot of like nervous Democrats are thinking, like, is there going to be a moment, right? Is there going to be a viral moment? And at the, I think we alluded to this a little in, you know, the previous episode of the podcast was just 2 days ago, but, you know, just recent. So we just did that one. I think we may have alluded to this a little in that episode of the podcast, but I think Kate mentioned that, you know, she was sort of on pins and needles of how it was going to go. And we were slacking a little just before the speech began, but I don't remember exactly what Kate slacked to sort of start it off, but it was, and I probably shouldn't, if I did remember, it probably be something I shouldn't say, but it was basically Kate told me she was like in a bit of a state, right? As things were about to get started. And I remember I joked, and I think this was, you know, they have all the dignitaries come in and finally they introduce the president. President comes down the hall, you know, shakes hands, smiles for selfies, all that kind of stuff. You had Marjorie Greene sort of like sullenly kind of berate him about something. And he was like, oh, what the fuck, you know, leave me alone. And he walked on, and he's talking to people, and he's down there hanging with the Supreme Court people, and he's laughing, slapping people's backs. And I said, like, you know, to Kate in the Slack, I said, looks vital to me. Think I've seen enough. Let's do this. All right. You know, like a Dave Wasserman thing. We've seen enough. All right. Yeah. That's all we need to see. But as I think that pretty much everybody agrees, he turned in a great performance. And some of that is that Republicans and some Democrats have so lowered the bar for him that he's, you know, doesn't know where he is and you know, can't string a few words together, that the fact that he gave a good, impassioned, pointed speech. He did what has been a kind of a novelty over the last dozen or 16 years or so. I mean, maybe goes back to that, you know, what was seen and rightly seen at the time as an outrageous incident in, I can't remember, was it, you know, Barack Obama's first day of the union or second, you know, the first, you lie thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which was shocking and rightly shocking. But I think we have seen that, and as it has evolved, I'm not sure it's a bad thing, that the State of the Union has become a little more, you know, a bit more like question time in the House of Commons, right? Where the prime minister kind of gets into it with the opposition. And, you know, we saw that last year where Marjorie Greene and Lauren Boebert, I think it was actually another member of the House too, but they were, you know, saying, oh, you're lying. And, you know, and here's the thing that is, if you've never, I haven't even been in the Capitol complex in many years at this point. I live in New York. I don't go down to DC that often. But I have been, and I actually covered Bill Clinton's impeachment in there. In any case, if you've never been in there, when you watch it on TV, it can kind of look like you're in a basketball stadium or something like that, or kind of, you know, that the crowd is way out there. But that's not how it is. Those people are really, really close. So when you see, you know, Marjorie Greene heckling on one camera and Biden up there at the lectern, you know, jousting with her, this isn't like she's 500 feet away. She's right there. They can hear each other talking. It's, I don't know what it is, 40 feet, something like that. Everything is very close up. So he did all that stuff. It was a very aggressive speech. He, you know, they liked how the exchanges with the Farrell Republicans went last time. And so there were a lot of things in there that was clearly him trying to like, let's do this, right? You know, kind of taunt them and get them to whatever. And he did that. And I think he did that well. So a lot of people came out of this. I won't pick on Kate, you know, certainly, you know, dodged of a big emotional upheaval, right? And that he did well. And look, I was there too. Let's not pick on Kate. But he did really well. And you could sort of see that what Republicans ended up criticizing, he's like, he's yelling constantly. He's out of control. Why is he, well, you know, he's got to calm down. You know, that's not much of a criticism in the context. And I think Biden's an old man, and he actually spent the last couple minutes trying to create a structure for him to talk about that wisdom, what I've seen before. I was the youngest senator. Now I'm the oldest president, all that kind of stuff. So that's still the case. We know that both of these guys are old guys. But I think that a lot of Democrats came out of this speech thinking like, okay, all right. I think he's up for this fight. No one knows what the outcome's going to be, but he's ready. He kind of turned this in. He did really well. I'm feeling a little better about it. So that is what we're going to talk about. That's my kind of basic take on it. And then of course we'll talk about the response, which was, I mean, she almost like, I'm almost mad at her. She almost stole the show. Right. I mean, how can you even really talk about Biden after you saw Katie Britt, if you did see her? In any case, Kate, how are you holding up?
Yeah. So I believe my exact words to Josh pre the speech were, I'm going to throw up. I would say my physical and emotional reaction was akin.
I 100% remembered, but I wanted to leave you to say it. I didn't want to.
No, I'm quite fine owning that. My feeling was akin to the fourth time that I took my driver's license test, which was the week before I left for college. And we had driven 4 hours into the middle of Pennsylvania to the first available slot so I could get it before I left. And I was contending with the reality that if I failed yet again, I would have to drive 4 hours back with my very angry dad in the car. So that's kind of where my headspace was at. That was like the feeling of nerves and nausea. I also told Josh that at that point, I think I would rather just give the speech myself. So Yeah, it was in a great place. It really helped that he took for frickin' ever to get up there. So it kind of had to endure the, here's Jill, here's the cabinet, finally, here's Joe. And he is like spending 20 minutes talking to Tim Burchett, you know? So the first kind of exciting moment we had was the Marjorie Taylor Greene gag, where she, as you alluded to, Josh, she came in like the Make America Great Again hat, and she was all festooned. And, you know, you're not supposed to wear hats or campaign gear on the floor of the house. I guess the sergeant at arms asked her to take it off or leave, and she just said no. So really a powerful institution, that sergeant at arms. But all she had these buttons, and it's all the story that, you know, I hadn't even heard of, but has been like dominating right-wing news recently, which is this college student, Laken Riley. And it's this, you know, horrible story where she was murdered by an undocumented immigrant. So as you can imagine, it's become the dominant story on the right. And she kind of appropriated this phrase, you know, say her name, that was primarily kind of popularized to, you know, commemorate particularly Black women, particularly Black trans women who have been killed by police. Anyway, so that was on her shirt. She had these buttons that said, you know, Laken Riley, and she kind of pushed one into Biden's hand. And you know, we'll get back to that when we're talking about the speech. But that was the kind of like, oh, moment of conflict kind of as he got up there, you know. And then he finally gets up. And it's the first time we have Mike Johnson sitting over one of his shoulders. You know, really funny to realize that he's had a different speaker for all of his States of the Union so far, Pelosi, McCarthy, and now Johnson. So Johnson was hard to keep your eyes off of because, I mean, look, we had McCarthy before, right? So this is not some kind of like institutionalist, like, you know, I respect for the president guy. Like, McCarthy can be as bitchy as the rest of them. But even in these like hyper polarized times, we're still kind of accustomed to seeing, even if there's an opposite party member behind the president, that they will stand on like the obvious stuff, right? Like taking care of veterans or like teaching children to read. But Johnson stood maybe like once total throughout the night.
I think he kept seating. He didn't stand up when Biden said, and we're going to cure cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's like, yeah, fuck that. Fuck that.
You could tell that he was like, had no idea kind of how to act during the Ukraine segment, which was the opening of the speech. Because, you know, obviously he's holding up Ukraine aid, so he couldn't exactly kind of give a full throated, like, yeah, I want to help Ukraine. But then that kind of positioned him in the way that, you know, Biden would say, we have to defeat Putin. And he just like sat there kind of sitting on his hands. And so that, you know, happened over and over again. And it seemed pretty clear to me that his strategy was to try to make Biden look stupid, to try to make the gaffe seem like a bigger deal. So, you know, he would do a lot of these like furrowed brow kind of like, I don't know what you're saying, you know, acting confused moments. But those were like so overshadowed by him kind of, you know, symbolically ceding all of these obvious, broad, popular issues to Democrats. And then probably the most remembered moment will be when Biden said, a lot of you in this chamber are trying to bury the truth on January 6th. And he just like rolled his eyes, you know, shaking his head. I mean, it was, even now, even when we're so hyper-polarized, I thought it was a bit startling. Like, I didn't really think that I could be startled anymore, but it was strange.
I think I probably lost count, but I think he only stood two or three times in the entire speech. And I made a note last night, I don't remember now, but they were, you know, there were a few things that are sort of like, you know, so uncontroversial and kind of all his members were standing up. But what my read on that, kind of from watching from the very beginning, I got the sense that it didn't dawn on him until they were going that like, oh, I'm behind him and everybody's going to see what I do. So I've got, you know, it's like he was figuring that out in real time, which is weird. It seemed like he was experimenting with different ways to sort of, stay out of the picture kind of, not literally stay out of the picture, but to, you know, do a general kind of slightly furrowed brow that maybe is I'm giving him some shade, but maybe I'm just watching intently. But the other part of that, that I was talking to a reader about this because it would be hard to describe to someone who was not watching it, but Kamala Harris was like Joe's hype man. I mean, she was the stander in chief, right? I mean, she just, you could just see that she was also having this, this relationship with the crowd where he would say something and she'd be like, fuck yeah. And just like bolt up, right? I want to see her knees. She's got to have like, you know, bionic knees or something like that, because she, and that was, I don't know, I talked to someone who actually, and it sounds kind of bizarre to say this, but I kind of felt something similar, that it actually changed this reader's impression of her. That this reader was like feeling a little more confident seeing her in the, you know, in the on deck position, because, and now that's kind of bizarre. She was standing up to applaud the president, but I did kind of feel that way. She kind of had this kind of, you know, synergistic relationship with him and the crowd through the thing.
Yeah. I thought her, which she, I'm sure, had been, you know, they train on this stuff as well. And I'm sure it really seemed obvious that her mandate was to, I mean, obviously all vice presidents do this to some degree, but to make him look as good as possible and to kind of err on the side of leaping up to start rounds of applause, even when it's not an obvious kind of inflection point. And this leads to one of my biggest points, which is I thought the MVP of the night has got to be congressional Democrats. Like, they put their shoulder into giving him exuberant reactions. And that matters a lot, because one of Biden's, you know, verbal tics, I think probably related to the stutter and trying to conquer it, is that he will swallow his words at the end of his sentences, or that's where he tends to kind of stumble. And that's difficult when you're giving a speech, because your applause lines are generally don't come in the middle of your sentence, right? And then when he kind of fumbles the last few words, it can give the sentence a bit of a hard landing, a sentence that's supposed to be, you know, triumphant or defiant or, you know, emotionally kind of punchy. But the congressional Democrats, because they were so exuberant and so had such a light trigger finger on big standing ovations, I thought they softened a lot of the landings of those sentences for Biden and kind of made his delivery seem better than it was, because, you know, it's a human thing. You know, when people kind of like, oh yeah, like totally, you start to think like, yeah, like, yeah, he said that well, you know, even if he didn't necessarily. Mm-hmm. And that, mm-hmm. again, and that's, you know, but all these things we're talking about, it's not like this is a novel part of the State of the Union. Like, the president's party is always there to be the friendly audience. But I just thought it was really notable last night how friendly they were. And, you know, that's got to be a factor of going in knowing that this is a huge, high stakes, important speech. Biden's got to do well. And to the point that they could help that, you know, either by kind of trying to pump him up himself, give him confidence while he's going, and to frame it to the audience like, yeah, that was a freaking great point and we're ecstatic about it. I thought they had a big effect on both sides of it.
No, I think that's right. And I do think that even beyond the level of that is self-interest, they're all in the same boat. We get that. That I do think, you know, there's been a lot of dialogue about, you know, divisions in the Democratic Party and Gaza and this and all these different kind of things, and people worried about his age and stuff. As much as, again, self-interest, I'm sure there was planning, but to me, despite all that, it was convincing that I think they like this guy, right? They're behind him. They want this to happen. So that, you know, it worked, even though, you know, nothing in these things is spontaneous, right? These things are all kind of thought through and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I will say that, I mean, you know, I don't want to be, you know, too ridiculously effusive, but I thought he did really well. And not just against the, you know, kind of like ridiculously low, you know, low bar that the opposition, I think, perhaps somewhat to their regret, has set for him. It was also a good speech in the sense that it was an aggressive speech. He went right at it, without naming Trump, saying the things he's done, stuff like on the immigration bill, on, you know, just kind of everything, you know, that part where, contrasting Reagan, the tear down this wall to Trump's do whatever the hell you want. It was very aggressive, and it's time to be aggressive.
Yeah. Right before we get into the speech itself, there's one more kind of purely reaction thing that I want to talk about, which is when Biden was going over the border bit and talking about the bill and, you know, what it would do and how it has majority support, if only they would kind of let it go through. One of the most fascinating moments of the speech was, and, you know, kudos to the C-SPAN camera operators, because they're always like on their stuff. Like as soon as a bill gets mentioned, they know exactly who to pan to, like who's the important person. And in this case, it was obviously James Lankford, right? He was the Republican negotiator who worked forever to put this bill together and then got kind of stabbed in the back by his own party. And look, Lankford is dyed-in-the-wool conservative, like a big anti-abortion, like religious conservative. And while Biden was kind of hitting the bullet points of what this bill would do, Lankford is nodding along, and you can see him at one point mouth, "That's true," in response to Biden. And I actually thought that was a stunning moment in the landscape of this speech, which was, as we said, Republicans sitting on their hands to a degree that I don't think we've seen before, even when it's a Democratic president that they hate. Like, they were just absolutely dead set coming into this on not ever showing approval of anything he did, no matter how innocuous. So that gave that moment, I think, like a lot of power, you know, seeing this like very, very conservative guy being like, yeah, the president's right. We should pass this bill.
And also he had it wasn't defeated exactly. He had a very sobered look on his face is how I describe it. And I'm sure whatever platform you're on, you can search it and it'll be everywhere. But he seemed to have a, like, defeated, not in the sense, I mean, he was defeated, they humiliated him, but that's not what I mean. I mean, defeated in the sense, because I think, maybe I'm misremembering this, but I think that part was in response to Biden saying something like, you know, and the Republicans cynically killed the bill, even though they know it's good. And it's him kind of saying like, you're right, Joe, we suck. We've met the enemy and it is us, kind of thing. I mean, obviously I'm embroidering it a bit, but he seemed, there was a look on his face kind of like, yeah, we were the problem. Sorry, Joe, you know? So yeah, I do think it was kind of and as you say, like the camera people, good camera work, right? You know, mm-hmm. Exactly. And in some ways it makes sense that the camera operators there know the legislative process. Yep. Right. So it's, you know who the sponsor is, or you know who the negotiator is,
but
and all that stuff.
We're good even beyond bills. Like, even when kind of just an issue gets mentioned in passing, they're good at knowing what, for which legislator, that's kind of a pet issue.
Yep.
But yeah, so on the speech itself, I mean, the highlights, it's funny because I was thinking if I was going to write about this speech in terms of substance and not kind of the performance and the theatrical aspect, I don't even know really what I would hinge it on, because it was, I guess the driving force was probably the economic populism piece. And I thought the part where Biden was most animated and commanding was the tax fairness section about, you know, how my predecessor had done this big, you know, the Trump tax cuts that only benefit the wealthy and corporations. You know, I'm a capitalist. I don't care if you make $1 billion, but you should pay your fair share, which is both true and smart, because there was this recent poll by this Blueprint firm, which is a Democratic aligned poll, that found one of the top issues for voters without a college degree and those making, I think, under $60,000 a year, their top concerns about Trump were letting rich tax cheats off the hook and, you know, taxing the middle class while kind of like letting the upper echelons off scot-free. So that's clearly, you know, a rich vein for Biden to kind of tap into. And I think one that he also believes in. So the speech, I think, was kind of dominated by that economic populism a little bit more than the one last year, which hinged, I think, a little bit more on the freedom tent, you know, whether that be kind of reproductive rights or the threat to democracy. I think the beating heart of this one was more of that kind of fighting for the middle class economic populism, bringing manufacturing back to America, like labor, all the stuff that kind of goes under that tent. Yeah, I would say that was kind of the driver of it, which makes sense because I was a little taken aback when you started with Ukraine because I mean, A, we generally don't hear foreign policy first thing in the speech. And B, you know, it's kind of a dark place to start. But I think it made sense within the contours of the speech because it kind of built from the, you know, fighting democracy at home and abroad. Here's my vision for a more equitable America. And then a little bit on the, you know, freedoms, whether that be reproductive, you know, marijuana, book bans, and then kind of driving out on this, I have an optimistic vision for America while, you know, my predecessor sees one of, you know, seething with resentment.
Yeah, I thought, I mean, one thing about the speech, I mean, he, you know, he had a couple guests there that were about the choice, reproductive rights, IVF issue. So it wasn't ignored, but that was certainly not the centerpiece of the speech. And I think that made sense in as much as if you care at all about reproductive rights and abortion rights, you know who's where, right? You don't need to be, you don't need to be reminded of that as much as you may need to be reminded on tax fairness and these other issues. It's coming up a lot, but I think you're right that taxes, jobs, these issues were sort of a centerpiece. And I think, as we know, there's some level of division over tactics and strategy among Democrats now. Should it be this kind of, you know, January 6th defending democracy versus, you know, kind of bread and butter stuff? I always think that those debates are a little over literal in the sense that, you know, January 6th did happen 3 years ago, but we're kind of doing January 6th every day because of the things that are just happening right now in our politics. And I think, you know, one of the big takeaways from 2022 was that voters were able to, walk and chew gum on, you know, choice, democracy, pocketbook issues, that they kind of like, yeah, it's all kind of one thing. So, yeah, I think that's right. And that was actually one of the issues that he was able to bait some of the Republicans in the chamber about Trump's tax policy, where he said, you know, are you going to do another huge giveaway of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to the wealthiest people? And I think you had a mix from the Republicans in the chamber, some saying like, hell yeah, but a number saying like, no, that's not true. And he's like, okay, cool. You've agreed not to give away a lot of more money to billionaires. Wahoo! Glad we've, mm-hmm. you know, sort of like what he did last year. So, you know, he hit those notes.
Yeah. I think overall, I didn't like the speech last night as much as I liked the one last year. I thought the one last night was a little, and this happens to a lot of State of the Unions, but a little laundry list-y in the way that some of the points that I think could have been resonant were rushed over. And that's in part because he talks really fast. So sometimes the punctuation doesn't land that hard. I think the point where that stuck out to me a lot was particularly he had this little section on marijuana policy where he said, you know, I want it to be rescheduled. Nobody should go to jail just for using marijuana. And that part just got kind of really skittered over.
But, I mean, honestly, I don't even remember that.
Yeah, it was like two
lines.
That's
how much it got skittered over. I didn't land for me. I don't even remember that part. So
but
to make your
I thought my two favorite moments of the speech, or my two favorite lines, were when he was doing the January 6th bit at the beginning. He said, "You can't love your country only when you win," which I thought was so good and such a good encapsulation of the MAGA illness, which is like, I'm a patriot, but if you lose the election, it's rigged, right? It was stolen. Like, that, I thought that was great. And I thought my absolute favorite moment of the speech, which was previewed in the excerpt, so clearly the writers also thought it was a good moment in the speech, but towards the end when he's doing his little age bit, I hadn't even formulated in my own mind what was the right way to come at it. You know, we'd seen the jokey I'm 800 years old stuff. We'd seen the it's wisdom, or, you know, it's not how old the person is, it's how old the ideas were. And all of those, I'm like, okay. But it wasn't perfect to me.
Yeah,
I thought
yeah.
what he did last night was perfect when he said, like, some people, you know, another person my age has come to, you know, have a vision of America that's one of resentment and revenge and vindictiveness, not me. You know, what I've seen of this country is a vision of optimism, of all we can be, of striving to be a better country. And I thought that was so good because it ticks so many boxes at once, right? It reminds listeners that Trump is the same age virtually. It does the whole, you know, Trump's kind of carnage speech versus Biden's optimism, which I think all but the most diehard MAGA people are obviously going to choose the nicer vision of America. I think it also gets into their characterological stuff. You know, Trump is a negative, fighty, chaotic guy. Biden is nice and thinks well of people and thinks well of the country. I just think it did all that work really efficiently, you know, in two or three sentences. So I thought that was a great place to land on that issue. That was also more powerful for me than some of the kind of self-deprecating stuff, which I think has a use, but also it lends credibility to the attacks in a way that this approach did not, I thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I also thought one, and I'm not sure, I don't know how much this will be focused on. I also thought, I mean, it wasn't a, for obvious reasons, it's not going to be something that any part of the Democratic coalition is going to be like, you know, boo-yang about. But I thought they handled the Israel-Gaza stuff quite well. And that is obviously not something that in partisan terms anybody is going to be excited about. It's a tough issue. It's a dark, horrible issue. Right. There's nothing to be excited about, but it was still critical. He had to address these two points. And I think I'm remembering this correctly about the timing and the cadence. But one thing that struck me is that he addressed basically October 7th and U.S. support for Israel, all of that kind of like, I'm behind Israel, I defend, you know, all that kind of stuff, which I think people lose track of. That is still where, you know, the country may have been overwhelmingly that way as recently as a decade ago, certainly 20 years ago. That is no longer the case, but that is still the majority vision in the United States. It's much more controversial, and much more controversial, obviously, within the Democratic Party. And then they didn't go immediately to, but you can't starve all these people, right? They actually had some other stuff between there and then came back to it, talked about their limits. It is your responsibility to protect civilians. You can't use aid as a, you know, a bargaining chip over, you know, hostages and stuff like this. And I think the speechwriters did a pretty good job at addressing those two things in ways that they needed to politically. He was very direct and very clear. And I think for people who want Biden to win, but are very upset about what's happening, he gave those people a series of quotes about saying, you can't do this. You have to allow this aid in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're obviously opening this sea bridge into Gaza to bring in more aid. So, I mean, this issue is certainly not solved, to put it mildly. And I don't think he has convinced any of the people who are, you know, out protesting on this, but he hit the points that I do think he needs to hit. And so I thought that was something that may not get as much attention because Democrats are kind of in the nature of things. They're going to want to be reliving the, you know, the applause lines and the attack lines and all that kind of stuff. But that was also another pretty important, pretty high stakes part of this speech, something this speech needed to accomplish. And I think they did what they needed to do in a situation where it's still going to be a problem after the speech, right? But you can't ignore it. You got to address it.
More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show. I thought actually one of his most important moments on Israel-Gaza came courtesy of the hot mics when he was handshaking his way out of the room. He was talking to Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado, who had clearly brought this up, or someone in the little huddle had brought it up. And you could hear him say, you know, I told Bibi we're going to have a come to Jesus. And at that point, one of his staffers swoops in and is like, Mr. President, you're on a hot mic. And the thing is, like, I couldn't quite tell if it really was an accident, like if Biden had forgotten that he was on a hot mic, because he had this guy flanking him the whole time who seemed to be kind of reminding him of that. And, you know, obviously, we know that Biden is a gaffe-happy guy, but he's also been in politics for a gajillion years. And I think it takes a little more than that to make him forget that everything he's saying is being picked up. So an interesting little coda to that section, you know, that pretty careful section in the speech that reveals a little bit of his, you know, the way he's leaning right now.
Yeah. And I mean, I have always followed this issue very closely. I follow the Israeli press very closely. So, I think people, for understandable reasons, don't get the level of intensity between and animosity between these two men. And that animosity was there long before October 7th. And it was sort of, you know, pushed to the side for a while because of the extremity of that moment. But it is, back with a fury. And, you know, people, perhaps for understandable reasons, some for disingenuous reasons, have this idea that the U.S.'s relationship with Israel is a command and control kind of relationship. And that is not the case. So, it doesn't surprise me that he is saying that. It also wouldn't surprise me if he had in the back of his mind that, you know, everything I say is picked up on some hot mic somewhere.
Yeah. So there are a few more moments I want to talk about. What I think was the worst moment of the speech for him was when he went rogue, when he off-roaded from the script to try to respond to Marjorie Taylor Greene's heckling during the immigration bit. And he had brought the button with Lake and Riley's name on it up to the lectern with him. And he pulled it out. This was the moment, aside to our readers, where I started actively, you know, pulling my hair out, just sheer panic. My flight mode was so activated. I was like, I'm going to run into the night. And I can see what he was trying to do. Okay, this was the part where he was talking about the border deal. And part of what the border deal's whole thrust is to try to like staff up, you know, these immigration courts and immigration judges and like the adjudication system, because right now it's so backlogged and so understaffed that like a lot of people coming through the system are not even getting dates to like adjudicate their asylum claims for years after they come. And he was trying to make the point. Well, he opened by kind of doing a nice Biden-esque, you know, that it's horrible what happened to her. You know, I so feel for her parents having lost children myself. And then he tried to transition it into a, and that's what I'm saying with this bill, which is that people will be less willing to pay all these thousands of dollars to kind of get smuggled into the United States if they know that they're going to get a court date, you know, in a few weeks, and then they're going to get booted out again, and it'll help kind of stem the tide. It wasn't really a neat transition, even if he had delivered it well, and he didn't deliver it well. And then on top of that, he used the term illegals twice to describe these people, which is so... It felt to me like it was not that long ago that even kind of pro-immigration people were talking about immigrants that way. But in our current environment, a Democrat would never refer to an immigrant calling them illegals. You know, it's like how Republicans like to call them aliens. You know, it's just, it's dehumanizing. And the party has moved on to, you know, usually undocumented immigrants to kind of talk about the people coming here, or migrants, or just immigrants. So it was jarring to hear. You know, it felt anachronistic. It felt kind of lacking in empathy. And then it made it tough, because then he gets back on track, and that section of his speech is, by the way, immigrants are good, right? They're kind of the lifeblood of this country. And it was it's hard to buy that case when you just kind of use this term to describe them, and talked about how the reason I want to pass this bill is to boot them out of this country so they don't keep killing innocent white women, right?
Yeah, his using that word definitely jumped out to me. It's one of these words that for, you know, most of my life in political journalism, that was just the word, you know, illegal aliens. And the shorthand for a lot of people was illegals. Although calling people illegals was always a slightly, even 20 years ago, I would have referred to people as illegal aliens. The technical legal term for someone who's not a citizen is an alien. I mean, obviously the language has evolved in such a way that that's kind of a weird way to, you know, when we say aliens, we mean people from other planets. So it's a little, it's a little weird. But certainly for the last, at some point upwards of 10 years ago, for Democrats, certainly for Democratic politicians, that's just not a word you use anymore. And he used it in an unrehearsed moment. I don't think it will be a huge issue for anybody who doesn't want it to be a huge issue for him, because of the overall cadence of the speech. But it certainly jumped out at me. It was not going to be something that was in the prepared remarks. And I did, and that with the thing with the, you know, lapel pin or whatever that was, it kind of had the makings of a powerful moment, but he just jumbled through it, and it was a kind of a chaotic kind of moment that just didn't work. So yeah, I you know, that was not one of the better moments. I don't think it's a moment that's really going to cause him a lot of trouble. And I do, you know, I will say, and I, you know, I said this in the sort of the wrap up I did last night, I think that there was really, you can only evaluate a speech in the context of a contingent political need, a specific thing you are trying to accomplish with that speech. And often we talk about like, oh, a speech was delivered great, or, you know, had a lot of thematic niceness or whatever. But mostly who cares? We're not, these people make political decisions. They're not, they don't give speeches, right? They're not actors or something like that. And in this one, there was the thing that was the first and the second and the third and probably the fourth goal of this speech was for him to show up there and for people to say, oh, okay, he's there, he's dynamic, he, you know, he's present, he's not like, you know, he's not doddering, he's not forgetting where he is and all this kind of stuff. Because, you know, there's this massive there's been this massive, I don't even want to call it a debate, it's more like a therapy session that Democrats have been in for months of, on the one hand, you've got lots of Democrats who are mad at Republicans, they're mad at the press for focusing on this, but they're also just worried at maybe some of it's true. And even if it's not true, it's going to prevent him from getting reelected because you've, you know, this impression has been created. So people are worried, like, do we really have a candidate here who's going to be able to do this? Right? Is he going to be able to show up at the key moments and really deliver? Or is it going to be awkward or worse than awkward and all this kind of stuff? And so he needed to turn in a performance where people come away from it, setting aside all the details, people come away from it like, okay, all right, he's there. He's got the fight and he wants to do this. And like, okay, let's do it. And I think he really accomplished that. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of very positive responses from Democrats, because setting aside all the things that we're saying were good, the few things that weren't great, in most ways, those things don't even really matter, because, you know, the ultimate proof in the pudding is that the criticisms for Republicans is that he was too angry or talking too loud. And like, okay, that tells me that you think you kind of whiffed on the senility stuff. And that's what he needed to do. And I think that's what he did. So in that sense, I think it was very successful.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it kind of calmed one of my concerns, which has been, we've talked in recent episodes about how the only possible way to address the Biden has his brains oozing out of his ears thing is to get him out there and show people that that's not true. And my concern about that has been, well, okay, but it's inevitable he's going to mess up. And is it still worth that if the only clip that ricochets around is, you know, him getting a name wrong or stumbling over a curb or something? But I think last night put me at ease a little bit about that, because, you know, it wasn't a perfect speech. Biden is not a gifted public speaker. You know, he fumbled some applause lines, like sometimes he would kind of skip over a word here or there. He had to go back and start a phrase over a few times. You know, he cleared his throat a lot. He kept doing these little coughing things that were like raising my heart rate. But all that being said, it's just, I completely agree with it, you, that you came out of it feeling like, okay, he can do this, right? He was spirited. He was energetic. He was pugilistic, you know, like, and that is what he had to do. And I realize that, you know, not everybody watches all 66 minutes of this speech, but it's important even if they don't, because the people who do are the ones who shape the framing and the coverage for everyone else. And you couldn't walk out of that with any other impression but vigor and aggression and willingness to kind of punch first. And that's what he needed to do. I completely agree with you. I think it wasn't my favorite speech. Again, he's not the most gifted speaker we've ever had as president, but what he had to do last night is to prove that he could kind of give a big, long policy speech when Republicans there were purposefully going to trip him up if they were given the opportunity. And on that front, you know, I think he passed with kind of flying colors. And there were two moments I want to talk about before we move on to the glorious, glorious response, where I thought he did some kind of bantery parrying with the crowd. And I thought he came off very well. One of those was, so he was talking about the infrastructure, bipartisan infrastructure law, and he was making a little quip about all of the Republicans who, you know, show up at the ribbon cuttings, but who voted against the bill. And, you know, he was funny about it. The Pete Buttigieg is like laughing his head off. All the Republicans are, or all the Democrats are laughing. And, you know, he kind of like gazes over to the Republican side and he's like, you know, if you don't want the money, just let me know. And that was really good. A little off the cuff moment. I thought the other one was even more impressive, because he, I think, blunted a moment that could have been bad for him, which was, he opened the kind of final section of his speech with, you know, in closing, or as I come to a close kind of thing, like indicating that the speech was ending, and all the Republicans like clapped and cheered, and he kind of laughed and he said, I know you want to go home, Lindsay, but you're going to have to listen to me for a little bit longer. And then it panned to Lindsey Graham, who was laughing a lot at that. And it kind of took the venom out of what Republicans did. It kind of made it a little bit more jousty. You know, it was a good way for Biden to remind everyone, like, yeah, I've been here forever. Like, I know these people. I'm not afraid of them. Like, they like me. They're friends with me. You know, this is all a political act in this very kind of little jokey
especially,
Uncle Joe way.
Especially with Lindsey Graham.
Right.
Since he used to be like best buds with Joe Biden, but then had to, you know, Donald Trump became his daddy. So he had to, like, you know, put on all this.
Exactly.
All this stuff.
Yeah. And so, you know, we found out that the hour like after the speech ended up being the best hour for fundraising for Biden all cycle, only to be topped by the hour after that, only to be topped by the hour after that. So there was a big response, you know, at least from Democrats, which, as you say, I think it's just not a small thing. Like, we've had Democrats freaking the fuck out for months and like being dour and negative and anxious. And I think, you know, we always talk about these things in terms of like, well, did he win over any voters? Like, I don't even know if that was the point of this speech. To some degree, this speech had to settle the base down, like make them confident, make them get behind him, get disillusioned Democrats to come, you know, come back into the camp. And from that vantage point, I think it was like a huge success.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, to put it in a slightly different way, no one wants to be investing in a losing bet, right? You're kind of, and it's not like, look, we don't know who's going to win the election, but no one wants to be in a position of kind of like, I got behind it and it was, I feel stupid now. And I think that the effect of this speech was to say, no, okay, we're in this and he's in this and let's do this. And that is that kind of, I mean, look, an army cannot function without morale. That is just one of the basic things about armies, about warfare. And there is a strong analogy to how a campaign works. People got to feel like they're in it. They have to feel like they're being pumped up and they're giving it their all is for a purpose, right? You have to do that. And on the point about, you know, non-partisan Democrats or people only kind of loosely tethered to the national political dialogue, I think the other impact of this speech, and I think it's a very important one, if you are someone who just kind of, you know, you see stuff on TikTok and you see, you know, the comedians on the late shows and just chatter and stuff like that, and you've had this idea like Biden is just like some elderly guy who you see at holidays who's, oh, hello, and, you know, kind of only half there. And if you just saw like 10 minutes of this, you'd kind of say like, that's not what I saw. I mean, he's obviously old, but that's just not what I saw. That didn't fit. And I think that, and for most of those people, they just haven't seen Biden, you know, not in this kind of context. So I think that is also a very important impact, a very important thing they were trying to achieve, that you've got people who've got a vague impression but haven't really seen much themselves. And you could watch the whole thing. You could watch half of the thing. You could just watch the first 15 minutes or any 15 minutes. And again, I think unless you were a committed Republican, in which case you're not part of the dynamic that I'm talking about, you would see this and you would almost have to say, okay, what I was hearing is not really what's going on. He's old, but that's not the case. And that is that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
And he bolstered that overall impression with his way out of the chamber, which, again, I'm not living in some fantasy land where I think everybody, you know, normal people watched the full 30 minutes it took him to handshake out. But you know what? Like, this stuff trickles through. The idea that they had to gavel out the House session and they like turned off the lights while he was still shaking hands with people. I think maybe one of the most kind of viral moments of the speech came in that time after, as we were discussing before we got on the air, which was, you know, Jerry Nadler kind of went up and was congratulating him and said, well, you know, they're not going to talk about your cognitive impairment now. And Biden kind of quips back, you know, some days I wish I was cognitively impaired. You know, it was a good, it was, it showed, you know, vitality. He outlasted everyone else. He stranded poor Kamala Harris up there with Mike Johnson for like ages because she can't leave until he leaves.
It never occurred to me.
She's just standing there stiffly next to him while he's, you know, talking to all these people, and they're coming up and being like, oh, my mom texted me. She loves you. She thought your speech was amazing. And he's like, well, give me your number. You know, I'll give her a call. And he's taking selfies and he's FaceTiming with people, and people are coming up and being like, oh, you might not remember me. I used to be a congressman from Detroit. And he's like, of course I do, blah blah blah, you know. Like, it's just a kind of Biden at the top of his game. When he went by the little military contingent, he asked one of the guys like, oh, you need anything, you know. It's very just like vintage Scranton Joe. And I think any, you know, it's not like each of these disparate things is going to change the narrative single-handedly, or that each of these like little details is going to trickle through to an uninformed and uninterested electorate. But it's all about building the case, right? And the speech was a huge plank of it. And these little, you know, he's out there, he's handshaking, he's in it, he's in the mix. Like, all of that can only help.
Yeah, no, and again, just on that earlier point, you've got a lot of people who just want to feel like they want to be reassured that there is a candidate and a standard bearer who's in this, can show up and deliver, and has the fight in him. And they got that. And that is, again, to me, and I have little doubt to the speechwriters and political people who planned the speech, that was first, second, third, 50th goal. Everything was kind of subsidiary to that, even though those things were important too. But that was the live or die thing that he had to do, and he did it.
So now let's conclude with the GOP rebuttal, which, as you say, Josh, nearly overshadowed the main event in its sheer bizarreness. And our listeners will remember that, like, these rebuttals are such a singular black hole in politics. Like, so, you know, for something that's usually only like 15 or 20 minutes, so incredibly, so just incredibly able to like destroy an entire political career. And, you know, hits of the past have been hammy Bobby Jindal, right? Or Marco Rubio like drinking a ton of water, or Joe Kennedy like having a weird amount of chapstick. Like, there's always something that just kind of makes it weird or makes it funny or makes it memorable. And last night it was Katie Britt, who's this new senator from Alabama. She was Shelby's chief of staff and then kind of inherited the seat from him. She's a mother, she's a Christian, you know, she's kind of like considered a rising star, in part because Republicans like have so few women.
Considered a rising star. Right. I'm not sure we're going to be seeing a lot of her after this.
So the ones they have kind of always get catapulted into, you know, leadership positions so they can just show they're not solely white men. And her, I mean, she was clearly mostly chosen for the age contrast, right? She's like 40 years younger than Biden. The hope was clearly he would kind of be feeble and then she would come on and be just glowing with youth. But her performance was so odd, so bizarre. I mean, first of all, she was sitting in a kitchen, which is like, oh my God. I get that they were probably trying to go for some relatable, you know, she's a family woman kind of thing, but like,
we need to FOIA whether she was wearing shoes.
Yeah, exactly. But like, stuffing the woman giving the GOP response in the kitchen is so tone deaf in this moment. And then, you know, the widespread reaction to it was she just kind of swung from one emotional extreme to the other with very little transition. So she went from, you know, describing like graphic gang rape and then swung over to, you know, we support babies in the party with like no thematic kind of continuity, and then delivered the speech. You know, things I was seeing was like a Hallmark actress or community theater or your first acting class, where it would be so tremulous on the brink of tears, and then over to a smile, and then over to grimness. I mean, it was bizarre.
No, it really. If you have not seen this, it's probably beyond our ability to really capture it, because when Kate said, you know, it's kind of like community theater. It was more over the top than your first acting attempt in community theater, or more like elementary school play. You know, it was, even that description doesn't quite capture it, to the point where I really don't know what they were trying to do, because it wasn't like she was a little over the top. It was, it almost seemed like it was kind of in jest, in the sense of she seemed like someone who was like on the verge of like a nervous breakdown, or hadn't, maybe someone who hadn't slept in a few weeks or something, you know, just kind of just boomeranging between this kind of, and, you know, a lot of gesticulating with her hands and stuff, and kind of mocking to Biden in one moment, and then like seemingly almost on the verge of tears, and then kind of like laughing, this kind, it was very strange. I don't, if you didn't see it, you got to watch it. Yeah. Because, you know, I, despite the humor that it has provided us over the years, I, when the Biden thing was done, again, going back to Kate and I's jitters going into this, when the speech was done, I was like, okay, my work here is done. I'm going to write this thing up. I don't need to see any more. And so I didn't watch it when it was live. And then, I was on social media and I just see people talking about it and kind of the way that I have just, you know, just described it. And the descriptions were so florid. I was like, all right, I gotta go back and watch this. And so I just kind of pulled it up on tape and I was just sort of flabbergasted. It was just so strange. I don't know any other way to put it. And, I mean, as I think I said at one point on Twitter while I was watching it, like, can they just, maybe they'll just replay this as the cold open on Saturday Night Live? Because I don't really know. I don't really know how much more you could, because literally her delivery of this speech is how you would expect the Saturday Night Live version of it to mock a kind of overdone version of a speech. That kind of like totally over the top, unbelievable stuff is what she actually did. And, you know, look, at some level, who cares, right? No one watches this thing. But it does become fodder for a lot of memes that percolate through the political world. And to the point of like Bobby Jindal, man, he was the golden boy of the future for years for Republicans, you know, Southern, South Asian, all the kind of stuff. And I mean, after that State of the Union, man, he was never heard from again, basically. I mean, he was still governor, but like the idea that he was the political future, his political future lasted for about 30 seconds after that performance. And I think it'll kind of be similar with her.
Well, that's why I think it's kind of important in terms of, and it's not important to her immediate future because she's quite young and she's, you know, from Alabama. So that's a safe Senate seat. She'll probably have that as long as she wants it. But she was one of the names that was kind of tentatively batted around as perhaps being on Trump's VP shortlist. Again, mostly because he seems to want a woman and there just aren't that many of them in the Republican Party. And for Trump, who it's so important to him, you know, to see showmanship and charisma, I mean, you know, she just got her name struck off that list. There's no way that he's going to countenance anyone who turned in a performance like that in her first kind of "Here, country, get to know me" performance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was strange, and it was a paradoxically nice coda to a fun night for Democrats, because, you know, you have the reassurance and relief of seeing Biden, you know, kind of turn in a very solid performance, and then you get this kind of, you know, what is it, you know, kind of palate cleanser, you know, kind of like aperitif of like, you know, end on this note of this Republican rising political star sort of crashing and burning as a little send off for the evening. So, you know, job well done from my perspective, Katie Britt. So, yeah, there we are. So I guess I guess we covered it. Yeah. So I'm sure everybody who's listening saw it. So you know, you have your own impressions. Those are ours. If you have not seen the reply, it's at least worth watching a couple minutes of it just to get an idea of what we're talking about. And it was pretty consistently that way through the whole thing. It's not like you had to catch the gaffe moment. It was pure gaffe, if you want to see it that way. So we will be back next week at our regular time, unless there's some other dramatic breaking news. And we will see you then on Wednesday.
All right. See you later.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.